I have
current geek.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Current Geek. This is the Current Geek Film Festival, a special monthly look at the greatest movies of all time. From a geeky, nerdy perspective, I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week, we are talking about the movie The Dark Knight.
That's right, Scott.
Oh, yeah, The Dark Knight. Yeah. Yeah, it's not even a good low voice. It's just more of a gravelly, like he's got a cold kind of voice.
In case you're confused, this is not Ben Affleck. It is not Val Kilmer. Yep. It's not George Clooney.
No Michael Keaton.
It's not Michael Keaton. Right. This is Christian Bale as Batman.
Yes, the worst of the voices of Batman. I'm not going to say he's Bruce Wayne.
I disagree. I find the Christian Bale Batman voice great. When I'm in the movie, it does immediately feel silly once I start thinking about it later.
It's hard for me. Like, I love the Nolan trilogy, and I think it's still, this particular film we're talking about today is my favorite comic book movie of all time, or comic book based movie. Still, even to this day.
And I think it's a lot of people's. That's why it's so high up on our list.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's really good. And part of it hinges, well, a huge amount of that hinges on the Joker performance. Like, it's just unbelievably good. But it's a really great movie. And all of it, I like the whole trilogy. My biggest problem with the trilogy, though, is 100% his voice. It's just that. Like, everything else is fine. Don't have a problem with just about any other plot point.
But
bit
Batman
of casting.
Always kind of talks like that. Is it just that he exaggerates it too much for your taste?
The one thing that the Affleck Batman did right, in my opinion, because I think everything else about that stuff's not great, but is the suit provided a voice modulator. So when you wear the suit, he would get this kind of, like, you know, lower tone thing, but it was artificial. It was created by, you know, there was a computer thing happening in his head or in his cowl. And they made a big deal out of that. That film.
And that fits in with the Batman as techno superhero.
Yes.
He doesn't have natural powers.
Exactly.
It's all about his, well, unless it's his supernaturally smart brain, right?
Right. He is a smart guy, the Tony Stark of this world, really, of the DC world. But I like when they did that, and I thought, oh, that's how this should be done. And I just wish that Nolan would have thought of that too, because I think it would have enhanced my enjoyment of the characterization. Everything else about Christian Bale's fine. I just don't think he has a good gravelly voice. And so when he pulls it out, I just go, it sounds like he got like a cold. It's not very good.
Well, it doesn't help that he's sitting right next to Morgan Freeman through a lot of the movie, too. The master of the deep gravelly voice.
Yeah, that's a good point. He's in this. Lucius Fox is in this more than he was in Begins or I even think the third one, Rising.
Yeah.
But anyway, The Dark Knight, 2008. We're talking 11 years ago now. Feels like yesterday. It was, in fact, that year's Nerdtacular film.
July 14th, 2008 in New York City, July 18th, 2008 for Salt Lake City and the rest of the United States, and July 25th, 2008 in the United Kingdom. This was a joint UK-US production.
Yeah, and I think it shows. I'm not sure why I think that, but I think it does. Mm. I don't know. There's a quality to it that feels, I don't know. Like, Nolan movies in general feel this way to me. And maybe it's because he's British. I don't know. But his movies always have the same kind of tone. I like that tone a lot. And I think that this is, of the three movies of the Batman trilogy, certainly his best of those three. And it's right up there with the best thing he's ever done, which I think is Inception, personally. I really liked Inception a lot.
That wasn't him.
Yeah, it was. Inception? Totally was him.
No.
Christopher Nolan? Yeah. Inception. Yeah, with Leo DiCaprio and all those guys. Totally him. Same director. Christopher Nolan made Inception and then it also had the German, what's the composer guy who did this thing? Anyway, takes him wherever he goes. He also did Inception's music. Some of the best soundtrack ever. Are you thinking of a different movie?
No. The only reason I said that is I was looking on IMDb for what he had done before this.
Yeah.
And I swear I did not see Inception, but there it is. Oh, he hadn't done Inception yet.
Inception was after
that's,
this. Yeah.
That's what is in my head.
Yeah, his in between.
He did do Inception. You're absolutely right. I apologize.
Right.
But he hadn't done it before The Dark Knight.
Correct. Yeah, right. It came afterwards, which is yeah. interesting. But in its own right. But he always does these great in between movies, and they kind of mark the trilogy. So he does Batman Begins. He had a lot of movies before this, Memento, and you know.
Well, I think that's important because I found it really interesting to watch this in a post Avengers Endgame world, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Up to this point, Christopher Nolan had only directed Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins, and The Prestige.
Right.
So he was thought to be a great director, a great young director because of Memento, and he mm-hmm. had done a really good job on Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. But he was still sort of a new guy, right? Yeah. Which is weird to think now that he has done Inception, as you say, Interstellar, Dunkirk, etc.
Right.
So I think that's really interesting, because the other thing to remember is, not only is Christopher Nolan the new guy, they're like, wow, they got that guy from Memento to do a superhero film. Well, mm-hmm. that's kind of a cool idea, right? Mm-hmm. That's now normal, right? Marvel has just taken that ball and run with it. But it was DC mm-hmm. who was doing it in 2008. And at this time, we all thought still DC was the only good comic book company at making movies.
Yeah. When did we get, was Iron Man that year? When was that? Cause that would have been the same year, right? 2008, we got Iron Man 1.
That sounds about right. Let me nail down the exact date, but yeah,
it does feel like
2008.
There was a hint that Marvel might soon know what they were doing because of Iron Man. It felt a little bit like, well, that could just be a one and done, and now we'll go back to making poopy adaptations.
Feige wasn't even in charge of the franchise yet. Marvel wasn't owned by Disney yet.
Right. Right. That was all up in the air.
And Iron Man was thought to be like, so really DC does the freaking Dark Knight, and the best you come at us was freaking Iron Man? Yeah. I mean, it was a good movie, but let's be honest, it's not one of your major characters.
Right. He's B-tier at the best at the time. Now, you know, that stuff's all A-tier.
Yeah, May 2nd, 2008. So it came out before The Dark Knight in that same summer. And I'll be honest, was eclipsed by it.
Oh, 100%.
We saw Iron Man not in the theater. Mm-hmm. We saw it on demand later.
Yeah.
We saw The Dark Knight day one.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For us, it was that Nerdtacular weekend, which made it special in its own right. But it was also such a great pull, because we didn't know if it was going to be really good or not until we saw it. And the year before that, we did Spider-Man 3, which was abysmal, was not good. And it kind of made for a bummer.
Oh, right. That's the other ding on Marvel at the time. It was like, man, Marvel makes things like Spider-Man. Sometimes they're good, but not this last one.
Yeah, and 3 was really bad. So people were not sure about this whole Iron Man thing. And yeah, like, we weren't in the place we're in now. And it's hard to remember a time when we weren't, where MCU and Marvel kind of ruled the roost.
I mean, I'm sorry to keep obsessing about it, but everyone talks about how great Marvel is at making movies, and they are. I'm not going to argue that they're not. But they don't have a movie as high up on these lists. And it's worth reminding people that I combined the American Film Institute, Rotten Tomatoes, and IMDb list together to sort of triangulate what should go on the current Geek Film Fest list. And Dark Knight is right up there near the top.
Yeah. What's great about Dark Knight is it's more than just, and I felt this way at the time, it felt like more than just a comic book movie. They didn't just stick to the comic book script. And by that, I mean, like, you know, all the obvious tropes that you would have in your comic book story. It felt like a good detective based sort of thinking man's approach to the story. It was very, it's basically a terrorist movie at the end of the day. Like, if you're going to try to plant this in a genre, it's a terrorist movie.
And this plot could sort of fit in a Die Hard-ish situation, right?
Mm-hmm, totally.
If you wanted to take the superhero out of it, it wouldn't be as compelling, I don't think.
No.
Because we haven't mentioned Heath Ledger yet, but wow.
Yeah.
Especially after just seeing Joker recently, Heath Ledger's Joker still stands. Yeah, oh,
it really does, right? It's something special. And the thing is, I remember all leading up to this, before the movie came out, 06, 07, when casting had been announced, everybody was just barking up a tree angry that this was the wrong cast. I can't believe you're putting Heath Ledger in this movie. This is a terrible idea. Like, this is one of my first examples of the modern internet having a meltdown about a thing they hadn't even seen yet based on, you know, predisposition toward a certain actor or something. And this is one of the most amazing performances of that decade. Like, straight up, out of any movie of any kind, it feels like it stands way up there near the top.
And so many little choices he makes, like the licking stuff that
chewing on his freaking scars that are, you know, you would assume are on the inside there. It's really gross to think about. But then there's a humor to him without him being the wacky Joker. He's got a timing to him and a, I don't know, it's really hard to explain. It's just sublime. There's been nothing like it. And I haven't seen the new Joker, so I can't say, you know, how this new thing compares. And I'm sure it can stand on its own for whatever it is. But as far as I'm concerned, Heath Ledger is the greatest Joker they ever made. He's just amazing. And if anything, I'm, you know, like, a lot of people were obviously very bummed when Heath Ledger died way too soon.
Before the movie came out, if I remember
right. Before the film even hit, that's right. And so he, you know, I don't know that he ever really got the proper accolades in awards and things and stuff like that. But also, we never got to see what he'd do next, because this was so singular of a performance that it still, 11 years later, just owns the film. In fact, I don't think this movie's nearly as good or would be as high up on this list without him in there. And without that, you know, the character, the way it is written in there, I think that makes all of the difference. Otherwise, everything else is pretty standard stuff. You know, it's escape from this and do this other thing. And, well, we got to go fight the deal. If they didn't have this kind of Joker causing this kind of havoc, I don't think Dark Knight is as good as it is. It's just that important to the,
I mean,
to the movie.
Like many of these films that we've talked about, Citizen Kane, Godfather, etc., there are things that are in this movie dialogue-wise that have worked their way into our daily lives that we forget are from this movie. Mm-hmm. Why so serious, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I still do a thing where I'll come into a room and there'll be people and I'll go, I've only got one question. Where's Harvey Dent? I'll do that all the time. And the kids do it. My kids are always like, Dad, where's Harvey Dent? Like, it's burned into us. And I think that maybe is the sign. Like, you and I've seen enough of these movies to notice a trend here, right? They all have these memorable cultural permanence to them. And I think that role in particular in that movie did it.
Well, and it's arguable that this movie isn't as good as other movies around it on our list. Mm-hmm. I find that to be especially true because we're down at number 26, you know, so the ones above it are Seven Samurai and Taxi Driver, and just below it, Treasure of Sierra Madre and Apocalypse Now. And when you start to think about that, you're like, well, is The Dark Knight really belong there? Mm. The first two thirds of the movie absolutely do. Mm-hmm. This is a well-filmed, well-constructed, well-written movie. It did start to drag a bit for me towards the end. Mm. It felt like I was getting a second movie.
My problem.
And yes. Yeah. It flows right in, right? Like, the Joker scars Harvey Dent. That turns Harvey Dent. Harvey Dent's turn to evil feels a little abrupt.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And also his time as Two-Face is super abrupt. Like, you get him for a hot minute and then he's dead. Like, what's the freaking point of building up this extra villain who is a hugely storied villain in the Gotham mythos? Like, you need that guy around. He's dead already. Like, all I could think of at the end of that movie, especially in the theaters, was, oh, he's not really dead. He can't be dead already, because we just got Harvey Dent. You don't just kill him. Like, he's got to carry on to whatever next sequel you're going to do or whatever. And at the time, we didn't know, you know, what 3 was going to be. But yeah, like, I feel like this movie suffered from a thing that a lot of these movies did back then, Spider-Man in particular, and they weren't quite used to letting go of this idea that you didn't have to have 3 villains in your movie. You could go with one. That's fine.
Yeah.
But these movies always tried to cram more in. So even at the beginning of this, you had a carryover from the Scarecrow. Mm-hmm. You had the mob is its own villain in a lot of ways, especially in the comics. And then you had the Joker, obviously, and then Harvey Dent. Like, you end up with 3 major Batman villains crammed into the same movie. And that was a problem with the Schumacher films. The reason you could argue that the first Tim Burton Batman movie was better than the rest was because it was the Joker and that's it. They didn't dink around with a million other characters. But by the time they got to Clooney and stuff, they've got Two-Face, they've got freaking the Riddler, they got Poison Ivy, all in the same movie. Like, what are you guys even doing? So I feel like they do that a little bit too much here, and it shows in that ending where everything feels a little sped up for the Harvey Dent arc, who it was played pretty deftly the whole time by Aaron Eckhart. Oh, yeah. Nice Utah connection, went to BYU, film grad over there. But anyway, he was great, and the makeup was really cool. The digital makeup they did was neat. I just think that whole arc got short shrift in the end, and it's a bummer. Just went too fast.
But there is no arguing that I think one of the reasons that The Dark Knight is considered so highly isn't just a handicapping of the scale because it's a superhero movie. Mm-hmm. Although I think that probably has something to do with it. I think it also has to do with the fact that it's proved to be very influential. And again, I like to go back to this a lot when we look at these movies and say, remember that there wasn't superhero movies like this before The Dark Knight. Now, Batman Begins had been like this somewhat, but The Dark Knight took it to a whole other level as far as the grittiness and reality. And superhero movies up to then had been glossy and comic-y. In fact, Spider-Man 3 suffered because it was too glossy and comic-y. Mm-hmm. And so this was new. Now we look at it and we're like, oh yeah, they do that dark superhero thing all the time, but boy, The Dark Knight did it better. Dark Knight did it in an unprecedented way. And it has been influential. Ryan Coogler said that Gotham City from The Dark Knight influenced his representation of Wakanda. I felt that when we see Lucius showing off the tech, I'm like, this is very much like Shuri in Black Panther.
Oh, for sure. Right. Like
Michael B. Jordan said that Heath Ledger's performance influenced his portrayal of Killmonger. Sam Mendes called The Dark Knight a game changer and influenced his approach to making Skyfall. Oh, wow. So when you have people out there saying, you know, when they get asked the question of like, what influenced you in making this movie? And they point to The Dark Knight. That shows why it's considered to be so quality, because so many people looked at it and said, wow, that's new, that's different, I want to emulate that.
Right. And they took a notoriously troubled franchise from what had been a little too, you know, very too cartoony in the 60s to a little too Tim Burton-y mm-hmm. in the 80s and 90s, and then took it to a place that was kind of relatable. Like, this city looks like a city. This doesn't look like a big cartoon land. This looks like a place where you could see city things happening. And yeah. There's little touches, and the first movie was this way too.
Smart to film it in Chicago.
I totally agree. Because Gotham always feels like Chicago in the comics anyway.
It does. And it allows you to feel like you're not seeing the same city, right? When it's New York, you're like, oh, that's New York, right? And Chicagoans are going to look at it and go, well, that's definitely Chicago. There's one very famous scene where you're seeing like the greatest architectural treasures of Chicago when you're going along the river there. But I feel like it did allow you to get a gritty kind of industrial feel that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Right. And sometimes the sun does come out. And sometimes, you know, like we can treat it like a real city with real people. And it gives it an edge of realism that they just haven't had in the past for that series. And so I really appreciate that. They still have the gothic elements of it, putting the gothic in Gotham, mm-hmm. but without it feeling like a Tim Burton Nightmare Before Christmas sort of set. And I really appreciate that. So to me, the whole thing is just grounded in a certain kind of reality that then they can just sort of play in that playground. And it is exceptionally good for what it's trying to do. And I wouldn't be surprised if this doesn't stay on this big giant 200 movie list for a very long time, because I think it deserves a spot. I mean, you could argue that, you know, it's toned down for PG-13 a little, and it's, you know, not as gritty as it could be, or there's a lot of things you could say about it. I mean, would I like a rated R take? Sure, probably, but you know, it's going for a general audience. But I think there's enough like Nolanisms here, like in tone and the way he films things, and I don't know, the kind of shots he does, the kind of edits he's known for. They're all pretty unique, and especially unique in a superhero context. So, yeah, I don't know how you top this. Like, what is the future of Batman? Where they can top that, I don't know.
Well, that's the problem. Yeah. And if I'm going to blame The Dark Knight for anything, it's showing how to make a really great, dark and gritty superhero film, leading everyone to think they too can make a dark and gritty superhero film. And we end up with Batman versus Superman, Suicide Squad, and even just a lot of large extent Justice League, mm-hmm. being joyless because they didn't understand how Nolan pulled it off.
Yeah. Yeah. And he doesn't have, as far as I can tell, he has no interest in picking this back up. He doesn't want to do this anymore. I mean, why would he? He got his time. He loved Batman. So he got the job and he got to do it, but he's not going to return to it. Although if they announced that tomorrow, I'd be super stoked, but you know,
I mean, that's not what Marvel did. Right. They didn't. I mean, yes, the Russo brothers did a number of these and including, you know, a couple of Avengers and in my opinion, the best Captain America. But
I think that's still my favorite Marvel movie.
They didn't do all of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they didn't do every Captain America. So if DC were to emulate that, they would have needed to find more Nolans, basically.
Right.
And I think they thought they had with Zack Snyder, and that didn't work.
No, it did not work. And I don't know. I mean, I am excited. The next run of Batman is in pre-production. The director of the two newest Planet of the Apes movies, not the first of that trilogy, but the final two, is the director.
Arguably are better. I like the first one too, but the other two really did elevate that franchise.
They're very good. I love those movies. And I like the tone, and I think it's the right. I think that might be the right guy for this. So that's cool. Script, you know, notwithstanding, because we don't know what that is yet. And then they've announced they've hired Foot Like a Face. What's his name?
Foot Like a Face?
Or Face Like a Foot. He has his face looks like a foot.
Andy Serkis?
No. No. To play Batman, it's...
Rob Pattinson.
That's it. Robert Pattinson. He has a face like a foot. Anyway.
Does he?
Yeah, and I keep hearing that new lighthouse thing that's coming out.
Like the Jennifer Aniston breath smell to me. Like I sort of understand what you're talking about.
I mean, I can't help it. It's all I think of. But he's an unknown in this role. I mean, we don't know how he would play this thing. But I'm going to just continue to have hopes for it. I think, you know, I had hopes for Zack Snyder. It didn't pan out. I will continue to have hopes for this. You know, Affleck's now out. They're not going to do his version of the movie, which was planned. He was going to direct.
The director
for a while.
Is Matt Reeves.
Matt Reeves, that's it. Yeah,
that's the person you were trying to.
Yeah, and he's great. I mean, at least based on those two Apes movies, I think that dude's cool. So we'll
he
see.
He did Dawn and War.
Yes.
For the Planet of the Apes, he did not do Rise.
No, Rise is okay, and I think they all deserve to be watched in sequence. But Rise is missing something that the other two have, and they are. If people saw those come and go, and you were like, meh, whatever, Planet of the Apes, that's dumb. Do yourselves a favor, catch up on that, because that was really
also awesome. When you go to IMDb, beware of spoilers, because they let you know that Robert Pattinson is not only playing the Batman but also Bruce Wayne.
Oh my gosh, we should have had a spoiler warning on the show about this. Just so you guys know, Batman and Bruce Wayne are the same guy. It's out now. It's out of the bag.
I like this. Also, I was about to mention the writers, and I caught myself because they list Bill Finger and Bob Kane.
Is the writer's great?
Well, they're getting writing because created by
sure.
credits. It looks like Matt Reeves and Mattson Tomlin are doing the screenplay.
Mm. Do we know this Tomlin from
Mattson Tomlin has written The Projectionist, which got did not get an Oscar nom for something, maybe not for screenplay. Mm. But I don't know. He's done a lot of smaller films. Solomon Grundy.
Born on Monday.
Dream Lover, which was a short. He did a lot of shorts. Mm. Solomon Grundy and The Projectionist being his only full screenplays to date.
Interesting.
Oh, he's also a director. Huh. He directed Solomon Grundy as well.
There is actually a cast listing. I'm a little surprised. You got Zoe Kravitz as Catwoman. That was recent, I guess. Paul Dano as the Riddler.
Jeffrey Wright as Commissioner Gordon.
Oh, that's great. That's a great pick.
And we're going to get the Riddler in this one. Looks like Paul Dano playing that one.
Yeah, and he's a psycho, so that could everything he plays is weird to me, so he'd be great.
I mean, he plays psychos very well.
Really, yeah, that's what I meant to say.
He is himself.
He's probably the nicest, most easy, laid-back guy. Yeah, I'm guessing. Anyway, we'll see how that goes. But you have to think that Matt Reeves and the producers and writers are just feeling that pressure again. It's time for us to see if we can compared to Nolan. It's almost like Nolan had the easy job, because Nolan was like, why are none of you taking a risk and just making this a more grounded, realistic, gritty take? Mm-hmm. Like, why aren't you just doing this? Are you reading the comics? Do you even know what those comics are? Why do you feel like there's the Burton and the Schumacher shadows loom at all? Just don't do any of that. Do this other thing. So if anything, I felt like he had the easy job, and now he has made it impossible for anyone else to be to do it without being compared.
You know what's funny? I hadn't actually thought about it this way before, but Nolan broke the chain for DC, and then DC decided to try to rebuild the chain. Yeah. And let me explain what I mean by that.
Okay.
Superman was the first of the big superhero feature films that became massively popular.
Right.
And it was a comic book movie in all respects. Mm-hmm. So when they tried to do Batman, I think what they did was say, let's do Superman, but with a different comic book take. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's why they got Tim Burton. So right. We want it to be comic booky, but in a darker way. And who does darker, glossy films? Well, Tim Burton.
Sure.
Right. So
sure.
That seemed to be a great choice. And then Marvel came along, and with Spider-Man, they're like, well, we'll do a comic-y, book-y movie too. And they did a pretty good job with the first Spider-Man. And each one was a little less well.
I don't know. I think two is better than one. Two's, I like two.
Oh, really? You think two? Okay. Yeah. But fair enough. I actually find things to like in three, but I don't necessarily think it's a great movie.
Right.
And so when The Dark Knight came, when Batman Begins came along, to be honest, Nolan said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something entirely different. Mm-hmm. And it worked.
Yeah.
But what has happened since is Marvel learned from that and said, oh, that's what we're doing wrong with Fantastic Four. Well, I guess, you know, it's not exactly Marvel doing Fantastic Four, but they're like, that's what we shouldn't do.
Right.
And you can see in the Hulk and even a bit in Iron Man, but definitely in the Hulk, them making that mistake, mm-hmm. right? Like trying to do something different, but also still trying to be comic booky. And then Feige sort of got them on the idea of like, no, we tell great stories, and those stories can be genre stories like Westerns or crime films. And then we just put them in the comic book universe, and that's how it works.
Right.
And instead of doing that, DC made the double mistake. This I'm working this out on paper, so just bear with me. This may be totally flawed, but I'm thinking maybe what DC did was, dark and gritty worked for Nolan. Great. We'll do dark and gritty because that's the DC brand, but we'll also do an extended universe because that seems to work for Marvel. And that isn't what Marvel did that was successful. Mm-hmm. Marvel came up with a new approach mm-hmm. and did the extended universe. Those are two separate and very difficult things.
Right. And they did it deftly. And now everyone's playing catch up. It's because it's kind of funny to watch because DC comes in, nails it. And then Marvel goes, oh, we can do that. And then they nail it. And then they nail it and nail it and nail it. And then DC's like, we need to nail it again. And they came in and went and didn't quite nail it. And then didn't quite nail it again. And it's like they forgot.
And maybe that explains the success of Joker, which is they said, okay, we don't care if it's dark and gritty, although it absolutely is. Just make a good movie. And so you get Taxi Driver.
Right.
But with Joker in it.
Right. Yeah, you're right. And back to my whole, this is a terrorist movie. This is what Marvel does with theirs. They make genre films with superheroes mm-hmm. in them. So my favorite Marvel movie is Winter Soldier. I love that one. It's my favorite. And it's the first Russo one. I think it's still my favorite. That isn't Spider-Verse, which I also freaking love, but that's Sony and, you know, it's not even connected. I mean, it's MCU, but it's not. Anyway.
It may be connected now that they've made peace. But
now they've all made peace. Who knows? But it's all good stuff. But I really like Winter Soldier. At the end of the day, Winter Soldier is a 1970s style mystery thriller. Like Ant-Man was a heist movie. Like they know what they're doing, and I think that's it. They're taking familiar genre filmmaking that people already love, and they're tacking their characters on it with good stories. And you know, it's not just cookie cutter by any stretch. And that's the right thing to do. And I think Dark Knight in particular did that exact thing. Whereas even Batman Begins didn't exactly do that. It was more of a straight, here's Batman learning how to do stuff and his ultimate bad guy is Liam Neeson and here's why. And it's great and all, but it's not a genre film that we're familiar with. It's a singular story. And I would say the same thing about the third movie, which I don't think is as good as this one. They're all good, but it's not as good. And it's because, again, it doesn't adhere to a genre everybody loves. So make it about a thing you know people already like. Heist movies, detective movies, terrorist movies, disaster movies. Whatever it is, you're going to have a better superhero film because of it. And I think Marvel figured that out.
I would go even a step further and say, make a good story. Make a good movie out of that story.
Right.
And gosh, you know what? Genres are genres because they've proven to be really good templates for making good stories and good movies. And there isn't a superhero genre, really.
Right.
The superhero isn't a kind of story. I think that's what Feige and Marvel discovered. And I think that's where Nolan's head was at, was I want to make a good movie. Mm-hmm. And I will pull from the characters. It's like, you don't make an African movie.
Right.
You make a really good war story or romance or thriller set in Africa.
Yep.
That's what makes it different from the one set in Los Angeles, is where it's set and the people that inhabit it. And it changes because of that setting and because of the people you put into it. But the setting isn't a genre. Why should the characters being superheroes be a genre unto itself?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's the secret to it. And I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that. And smarter people than me would say so. And certainly people should email in. But on a very, very basic level, this movie feels like it understood that. The Marvel movies seem to understand that. And I really hope they can return to Batman in that way. I want Batman to live and breathe in that way again and not be so stifled by what they have done recently. And they need a win over there. I mean, they did well with Shazam. Or not Shazam. Captain Marvel. No, they called it Shazam, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That was good. People liked it. That felt like a movie that had learned. Because
they made a comedy.
Yes, and it needed to be. And they also, not only that, they just knew, like you just said, they did the template, and they did their great story in a familiar setting that happened to be superheroes. And it worked out really well for them. So I hope that was a learning moment. Wonder Woman did similar things. Aquaman, kind of, sort of. But there's a real chance here for Batman to get his glory back, and he deserves it. He's the greatest. I mean, I'm just going to say it. Here's a controversial opinion, hot take. He's the greatest superhero in the history of comic books, in my opinion, and always will be. I love him. I love him. I think he stands the absolute test of time and will always be cool to me. Batman will never not be cool to me, and he speaks to me on every level. So he deserves better from me, a lifelong fan. Superman's okay, whatever. All these other heroes, they're fine. I like the Hulk. I like Thor. Those guys are all right. Like, those guys are all cool, but nobody's Batman. Like, he is the dude. And he should be treated as such. He needs the best possible cinematic treatment.
I think what they could do, and I'm not saying this is what they will do or even what they should do, but what they could do that Nolan didn't do is make a detective story.
Yeah.
Because that is one aspect of Batman we haven't really seen emphasized.
Anywhere but the comics. The comics are full of it, but...
Oh, yeah. No, I know. And that's where I'm pulling that from, obviously. I mean, Batman number one is Detective Comics, for goodness sake, right?
Sure.
So if you really focus on that, he's like a tech wizard detective who evolves into Batman. Please don't give us another origin story. You just did it in Joker. It's fine. Yeah. We don't need to see Martha.
Plus, every Batman movie, with the exception of this one, it shows the parents in the stupid alleyway getting shot again and him witnessing it. Don't do that anymore. We all know it. We all know it. It's like part of our cultural zeitgeist to know that already.
And maybe that's why it's in Joker.
Maybe.
Because it does feel a little weird that it's in Joker to me.
Yeah.
It's important because, not to make this into a Joker movie, it's important that it's in Joker because that's important to the formation of Joker in that respect. But it was a little weird that they're like, oh, okay, we're taking a turn into that. Mm-hmm. But maybe the Batman, which is what the Pattinson movie will be called, maybe that carries on after that, right? And we just don't need to go back to that.
Yeah, if this is young Batman early in his Bat career, just get right to it. Like, we know.
Oh, what if it was a private detective film? What if it was like a noir Big Sleep kind of thing, right?
All right.
And he's trying to make it just as a straight private detective, and Lieutenant Gordon isn't helping him out any. Mm-hmm. And so he just starts taking things farther and farther, and that's how he becomes the Batman.
Yeah, that would be all right. And again, it gives you all that detective bent on it. You have all the intrigue that comes with that sort of storytelling. Like, there's a real chance here to go places. What I'm not looking for is just another roller coaster ride in the movie theater. And that's why I like this Batman and the other Nolan Batmans, is they're not just roller coaster rides. They have their action scenes and they're very good. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. And your movie will have it, but that does not need to be the focus. Like, there's a reason why the most memorable line from this, probably the most memorable two lines, are "Why So Serious?" and the other being "Some men just like to watch the world burn."
I know. When that one came across, and I know this was not the first movie to ever say it, but I'm like, oh, right. That, yeah. Most people are alluding to this movie when they say that.
Yeah, they're all thinking of Michael Caine. Yeah. Very, very kindly reminding Batman that there are some people who you just cannot deal with. And also, by the way, I think is a huge part of this movie's success is the just the pure anarchy of the Joker. And they make it clear a number of times that he's just a nihilist. He's just, you know, there's no reasoning with him. There's no trying to talk him out of anything. Chaos. Right. He's an agent of chaos.
In his own words.
In his own words and his own actions. And at one point he says to Harvey Dent, while Harvey's in the bed, he says, I'm going to paraphrase it. I can't remember exactly, but it was something like, you know, no hard feelings because I don't have any. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. The reason and now I need you.
Yeah. And this is the only time anyone's going to say no hard feelings to you that actually means it, because I really don't care.
Right. Because I don't have feelings. So they can't be hard.
Yeah. And that is so infuriating. If you ever know anybody like that in real life, it's the most infuriating thing ever. And usually they're, you know, psychos and do terrible things, but it really builds him up to be a character that you cannot take your eyes away from, but you also just hate. You're like, gosh dang it, he is the worst thing. And he's the worst thing because he's the exact opposite of Batman's one rule, which is not to truly harm anyone regardless of what they've done. And he'll harm everyone regardless of what they've done.
And what I like is the typical comic book approach to that is to really hang a flag on that.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to hurt someone, so I'm going to hurt someone and you won't be, you know. And while they use that exact trope here, I mean, it's key to the situation where he's got Harvey in one and Rachel in the other place. And mm-hmm. it's like, you're going to have to hurt somebody. He's not doing it because he wants to one up Batman. He's doing it because he's not playing the same game as Batman.
Right. Right.
And that's what's so brilliant about him is he wins because he's like, you all think we're playing this kind of game and I'm not. Mm-hmm. And you haven't caught on to that yet. So you will never catch up to me.
Yeah. I think that's an eternal idea that works on lots of levels, and it causes real anxiety for the watcher, which makes for a great movie. Because we know
even on review, even on repeat. You know, I've seen this movie a couple of times now.
To me, it's like modern war. You know, it's no longer everybody lines up in a line, gets up to the line of scrimmage and says, all right, on the count of three, we fight.
We will now charge across the field, infantry.
Like, this gentleman's war doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. And so the idea that Batman could work within those rule sets because most of the world still adheres to them, here's somebody who's just defying it, who's just not playing, like you said, not even in the same game.
And some of it's just simple con tricks. Like, I will tell you Rachel's in this building, but she's not. She's in the other one. Yeah. I will tell the boats that I will blow them up at midnight and then fail to do so. Right. Oops.
Yeah.
Although in that case, he really could have. He was just being a little bit distracted by Batman beating him up.
Right. Which can happen. But I'll never forget, like, the introduction of the Joker was at the bank, but that was pretty brief. The real introduction is when he shows up at the mob meeting in that kitchen.
Yeah, that's basement. When you meet who he is.
Yeah, and when he makes that
pencil.
You sort
of get that he's a trickster because he hides himself in the team.
Right.
But yeah, you don't meet his personality till that meeting.
And when he does the disappearing pencil trick, I mean, it is still one of my favorite moments in movies.
See, it's gone.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
And that's a great example of the humor of the Joker being not funny, but humor.
It's exactly how it should be. He's got it
like,
right.
He thinks it's hilarious, right?
I mean, in your opinion, since you've seen both, and I have not seen the Joker yet, the new movie.
Mm-hmm.
Does he get that part right? Does it feel like he's
It's an entirely different approach to the character, and there's even arguments about whether this is the Joker or just a Joker that maybe inspires the real Joker later.
Oh, interesting. Because it is set in the 70s, and Bruce Wayne's what, like a kid?
I think it's set in like 1981, something like that. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Bruce Wayne's young or something. Speaking of which, if we're going to get picky about the kind of cool Batman things we'd like to see that they'll never do, I always like when the Batman comics decide to go period piece and they're like set in the 20s or something, or steampunk Batman.
Yeah, I like all that weird stuff. Pattinson, but that'd be so cool.
They'll never do it, but man,
I mean, that's cool. When you do that noir detective take on Batman.
You even make it black and white if you want to. I don't care.
Yeah.
Just shadow that thing up, make it rad.
You could Wizard of Oz it, make it go color at one point.
Yeah. Why not? Or what do you see? Schindler's List, a little girl's red jacket thing, only color in the movie. You could do the
only the pearls from Martha.
Yeah, only the pearls have color.
Which is really just white, so you're not gonna really be able to tell, but
oh, the Marthas. That's just like the sum up of why those last movies were just so stupid. Anyway, Batman, Dark Knight. It's awesome. People should watch it. If you have never seen it, what are you even doing? Who are you?
Dark.
Yeah.
Night.
Dark Knight. And the movie doesn't, they actually don't say the title of the movie until the very final scene as he's driving out of that parking garage and you hear Commissioner Gordon played fabulously by, what's his name? My brain just went dead. What's his name? Who played Gordon?
I had this page open too and I closed it.
I'm losing my mind.
I can't remember either.
I'm going to find it because I'm super annoyed. Okay. I can't find it. He's an award-winning actor.
Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman, geez. He's narrating the final thing and he says a bunch of stuff and he says he's the Dark Knight and he leaves. And I always love it when a movie says its own name. It's a thing I enjoy. Anyway, available now, rentable everywhere, but not streaming currently. Best I could tell. Oh, no, that's not true. There is some service that is streaming it. It's called, it's some weird name. But it's like a voodoo type service that I'd never heard of. They're currently
streaming. Is that right?
Yeah. I can't remember the name of it. I could look it
up. Oh, it was streaming on Sling TV a month ago, but it's no longer there anymore.
Yeah.
Is that what you're thinking of?
Or yeah, possibly. I also saw it on HBO for a brief time, and then it went away from there.
Yeah. I mean, it's making the rounds of on-demand providers, like HBO and Sling TV. So that's why it's not streaming on like a Netflix or an Amazon. It will be coming to HBO Max, one would assume, once that launches.
Oh, yeah. It's the one I saw is gone now. So you're right. It's not there anymore. All right. Well, you can get it on Redbox for $3.99.
Yeah. I mean, you can do well. So you can just rent it digitally for a few bucks. And it's definitely worth it.
It's very,
you can
very
rent
good.
It, you know, rent it through Amazon or Apple or Google Play, any of those.
Kind of makes me want to watch the third one again because that's the only one I've only seen once. I feel like I ought to probably revisit the third and see what Bane's like these days because I love me some Tom Hardy. I'll probably do that. Anyway, so do check that out. Hey, a reminder as you leave us today, everybody, don't forget to stick around for Legal Geek because he's going to talk this week about how Ms. Pac-Man rights are being fought for in court as the 1981 game remains profitable with an explanation of copyright termination practices in the U.S., who knew that Ms. Pac-Man might be on the verge of going open source or who knows what that thing's doing?
Eating up those rights.
Who knows? Eating rights like dots on a screen.
Yep.
Anyway, that's coming up soon. Don't forget also you can support this show at patreon.com/currentgeek. That's patreon.com/currentgeek. Tom, do you have anything else you want to mention before we go?
Next month, King Kong, the 1933 version of King Kong. There are many versions of King Kong out there. This one has both the words King and Kong in the title and is from 1933. And as far as I could tell, that one is also only available for rental or purchase, but it is available in all the major stores. So
nice.
You should be able to find it for a few dollars if you want.
Go check that out. For me, just find everything else you're looking for at frogpants.com. This show, of course, can be found over at currentgeek.com. We are Current Geek on Twitter. Ace to Tech for Tom. I'm at Scott Johnson. Talk to us there as well. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we review a current lawsuit in California showing that the rights to the arcade classic Ms. Pac-Man are still very valuable, at least to the two parties in dispute. Bandai Namco is the rights holder for publishing the Pac-Man and Ms. Pac-Man games in America. Bandai has sued a maker of retro game systems called At Games Holdings for alleged trademark and copyright infringement over the use of Ms. Pac-Man concepts and assets. Despite being initially released to video arcades in 1981 as a sequel to the original Pac-Man, the desire for players to continue playing this game remains high, and thus, the IP rights remain very valuable. At Games had previously dealt with Bandai in a license agreement over the original Pac-Man game, Apparently, the quality of the game products brought to market did not comport with what Bandai expected and demanded. And as such, AtGames lost the license to make this game. When AtGames approached Bandai again for a license for Ms. Pac-Man, Bandai refused. Trying to find another route to these rights, AtGames has apparently engaged with the game's original inventor to purchase some rights to Ms. Pac-Man. AtGames then began producing a couple prototypes and discussed them with retailers. Bandai sued AtGames a few weeks ago over this, asking in addition for a temporary restraining order to stop any activities of AtGames in this regard. So if both companies hold some legitimate rights to the property, who will win? Assuming this case does not settle, the odds still favor Bandai at this early stage of the proceedings. Although it is unclear what exact rights were sold by the inventor to AtGames, one possibility is the copyright termination right now provided to authors of works that were made on or after 1978. And if this is the case, an interesting split of rights will eventually occur. Authors have the right in the U.S. to terminate any copyright assignment or license previously made after 35 or 40 years from the grant of rights or publication, so long as notice is provided sometime after the 25 or 30-year mark. This allows authors or their estates to have another chance to negotiate rights transfers, particularly for creative copyright works that are of significant ongoing value. Assuming any copyright the inventor held was assigned to Namco around 1980 or 81, the 35-year term from publication ran out a couple years ago, and so this work would be eligible for a termination proceeding. Thus, AtGames may potentially have some of the copyright rights moving forward under this scenario, while Bandai, of course, continues to own the trademark rights they have developed from four decades in the marketplace. Those trademark rights are exactly why I think Bandai has the upper hand in the early stages of this conflict. Regardless, the split in rights could force the parties to the negotiation table to figure out a resolution that allows both to continue practicing and exploiting the Ms. Pac-Man IP. Otherwise, both parties could be locked in a standstill with no products being available to end consumers. Who knew a classic arcade game could raise such complex legal issues? The bottom line is, protecting the ongoing long-term revenue stream from Ms. Pac-Man is obviously important to Bandai, so it makes sense that they have brought AtGames into court to try to stop competition. However, really old properties can be subject to things like copyright termination, and that complicates the ownership issues, providing leverage to third parties like AtGames. It's an interesting legal conundrum we will keep our eyes on. If there's any lesson to be learned for the common man here, it is that when license negotiations for rights break down, it is exceedingly hard to find alternative ways to properly obtain and use the rights. So it is generally better to move on to another property rather than risk a lawsuit. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.